Our first argument this morning involves three consolidated cases, number 031676, Buckley versus Wilkins, number 031713, Gibbs versus Wilkins, and number 041614, Jewett versus Wilkins. And I understand appearing on behalf of the appellants in all three cases, Mr. Jewett. Yes.
The cases have been consolidated, but as the court is aware, I have been suspended from the practice of law. Therefore, I'm not permitted to appear on behalf of other individuals before this court or any other court in the state of Ohio. However, it is clear that the legal positions that I have taken with regard to my own case is substantially the same as the legal positions that I offered when I was practicing and appearing on behalf of Ms. Buckley and Mr. and Mrs. Gibbs. Therefore, the arguments that I will make in my own case are equally applicable by reference, as it were. One of the things that I want to make mention of to the court is that after I filed my initial brief, additional information came to my attention, which I think will provide a better explanation of the reasons why I take the legal position that I take. And therefore, I am submitting a reply brief to the appellant's brief, which will include that information, which came to my attention after I filed my initial brief. However, and I won't make reference to those arguments except sort of tangentially, because they haven't been briefed yet. So I don't want to confuse the court or counsel for the appellee with regard to those references. But with regard to the initial issues here, and further, is it possible for me to reserve some time to reply?
Yes.
So I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may, please. Okay. Thank you very much. With regard to the initial brief that I filed, probably the most important proposition is proposition of law number 4. And in that proposition, I indicate that when a person filing an Ohio income tax return indicates zero federal and state of Ohio adjusted gross income, the state of Ohio has no authority to impose an income tax on that person because the person has no federal or Ohio adjusted gross income upon which to impose an income tax pursuant to 574702. And I cite in support thereof several United States Supreme Court cases, including Merchants Loan and Trust Company versus Matanka, and Doyle versus Mitchell, and Eisner versus Maycumber, as well as some other cases. Counsel for the appellee never addressed any of those issues in his reply brief.
How is that to work in practice if everyone indicates I have zero income? Is it your position the tax commissioner can't question any of those returns and therefore collect no income tax that year from anyone in Ohio? How does it
work? Well,
that's
correct. And the reason why is because the state of Ohio has chosen to base its income tax collection process using definitions used in the Internal Revenue Code.
So is it your position no one in Ohio owes any income tax? Is there anyone who does?
At this time, based upon the information that I have, I know that I don't owe any, and I don't believe any of my clients owe any, and I believe that every other person who looks at the law the way it is can determine for themselves whether or not they owe any taxes. I don't believe that I personally don't believe that they any so-called income taxes. Now, this argument is separate and apart from any Fifth Amendment argument that could be made that a person can't be compelled to be a witness against himself. Pardon me if I may.
Have you made similar challenges to the federal income tax?
That's correct.
What has happened in those
The
challenges?
End result of those challenges in tax court, and Mr. Hubbard has made reference to my suspension in tax court, has been that tax court has made a determination that those arguments are frivolous. Now, I did not have the information I now have to present to tax court at that time. I believe, and the suspension that was imposed upon me by tax court has been appealed by me to the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is the appropriate venue. I'll be making those arguments before them. If, in fact, as I believe will happen, my suspension will be reversed based upon my arguments, then the so-called frivolous argument made by the tax court will be rendered inapplicable. Yes, tax court has rejected my arguments because they weren't properly framed. As the court is well aware, very often decisions aren't rendered until the properly framed case comes along. It's my belief that I am in the process of preparing that properly framed case so that the issues will finally become clear. And so in order for me to answer your question, I think it's necessary for me to refer to this new information. The new information basically is this, that the Internal Revenue Code not only contains statute law that is applicable today, but it contains by reference previously enacted laws. And those laws are not clear to most of us. Most of us believe that we are taxpayers within the meaning of the Internal Revenue Code. What the Internal Revenue Code says is a taxpayer is a person who is obligated to pay a tax, okay? One of the things that I have always said all along is that there's no section of the Internal Revenue Code which makes me liable for the so-called income tax. Liability is a requirement in order to have to pay a tax. Imposition of a tax doesn't make one liable for a tax. So, in effect, if you are not a taxpayer within the meaning of the Internal Revenue Code, then you are not obligated to pay the tax. What the Internal Revenue Code has managed to do is to create, in effect, a web of deceit that convinces most people that they are liable for the tax, even though no section of the code says they're liable for the tax. The end result being that most people voluntarily assess themselves as owing some tax. Another thing that you need to understand, and again, I'm referring to something that I'll refer to in my brief, in my reply brief. The term income and the term employer and the term employee don't mean what we think they mean. They mean certain specific things within the meaning of the Internal Revenue Code. And they don't mean us. They don't mean individuals who are simply people out walking around earning their own livings.
Have your arguments met with success in any court?
No, they have not, as yet. However, I will point out that in 1896, everyone knew in the United States that separate but equal was not equal. But Plessy versus Ferguson said that it was. And it wasn't until 1954 that the United States Supreme Court reversed itself on that issue. So I've only been at it for 15 years, but I think I'm a lot closer than the people in Plessy versus that were fighting the Plessy versus Ferguson case were. So I don't think it's going to take 60 some years to get this issue resolved. I think it will be resolved reasonably soon. But in any event, no, I have not been successful so far. But a lot of people haven't been successful. Abraham Lincoln, for one, was a failure at various things until he became extremely successful. So in that regard, The fact that I have not been successful so far is only an indication that I haven't been successful so far. As after World War II was over, Sir Winston Churchill was invited to the United States, and he was asked to speak to a large group of people on how England contributed to defeating the Nazis and the other Axis powers in World War II. And after he was introduced with a fulsome introduction, he stood up and he said, "Never, ever, 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 ever give in." I believe that that is the appropriate stance in this case. And I believe that, like Winston Churchill, even in the darkest days, and it's always darkest before the dawn, that the legal position that I've taken will ultimately be vindicated, and that individuals will then know that they have a choice. And that choice is, I am not a person who is a taxpayer within the meaning of the Internal Revenue Code, and therefore I'm not a person who's a taxpayer within the meaning of the Ohio Revised Code. The code has been written in a way, both the Ohio Revised Code and the Internal Revenue Code have been written in such a way. Am I getting close to my 10 minutes, sir?
You may want to.
Okay.
Reserve the balance of your time.
Let me stop then and reserve some time. Thank you very much, sir.
And Mr. Hubbard for the appellees.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. We've heard today the same litany of rejected arguments from Mr. Jewett that he's maintained for over 10 years. The tax court order and the SIR memorandum in support of that order reviewed in detail Mr. Jewett's arguments. At page 17 of that SIR memorandum, the court, and I want to quote the language because I think it's particularly pertinent here. States, Mr. Jewett has aggravated his misconduct in the cases cited in the show cause order by showing no remorse for such misconduct, and instead persisting and advancing in his response to that order and at the hearing the same types of frivolous arguments that he advanced in those cases, by arguing that the income tax is entirely voluntary and that it must equate to some corporate activity, which is what he's advocated when he was citing to those U.S. Supreme Court cases that he said were unresponded to by the appellee. Mr. Jewett is simply repeating what has long been rejected. We have an individual income tax. The cases he's citing relate to the corporate income tax. So the language in those cases that speak to corporate activity are referring to the corporate income tax, not the income tax imposed on individuals, which is at issue federally and as well as through the Ohio personal income tax. So those cases are clearly inapplicable. The courts have long rejected them. It's not just the tax court that's rejected these arguments. It's every court that's ever addressed these, including several federal appellate courts. We cite those in our brief.
I'm curious about this Pat Jeffries.
Pat Jeffries.
Talk to me about that.
Sure. Pat Jeffries is a sorting mechanism used for zero filed returns. Zeroed returns are zero returns, or returns that are filed showing no income. Frequently, they're filed for purposes of obtaining a refund. In fact, that's the only situation I'm aware of where you get zeroed returns. Where we're referring to zeroed returns where there actually is income. Now, somebody can be an out-of-state resident and they're filing a return showing no income, or they might have a loss from their business, so they have negative income. Those might be referred to as zeroed returns as well, but when we have a zeroed return situation, the income tax audit division sorts that kind of return out and assigns the name Pat Jeffries to it, because those are such routine situations, and the auditors involved, the tax commissioner's auditors involved in that, can switch. So that way, the division knows that it's a zeroed file return situation. And as I said, some of those zero file return situations are legitimate in terms of there is no income as the courts have defined it, as the commissioner administers the tax. But many of the zero file returns, particularly when they're accompanied by W-2s showing positive income, are filed by the tax protesters. So the Pat Jeffries sorting mechanism that you see on the correspondence involving the zero file returns is primarily for the purpose of sorting. In the event that the personnel involved in that compliance function changes, which is frequently the case. So in addition to that, there was testimony by James Bauman, who was the and is the tax commissioner's administrator of the income tax division. In addition to the sorting mechanism, it's also for purposes of protecting the identity of individual agents from harassment from the tax protester movement. You can see on their websites, oftentimes when they get the names of individuals from their government employees, they'll seek their home addresses, and there's harassment. Certainly there's a lot of threats on the internet. I'm not aware of any physical violence that's occurred, but that's always a possibility, and certainly is a possibility for harassment. And ultimately, of course, this is what we're talking about here is correspondence that the division is having with a particular individual. That individual due process rights are fully protected. They have rights of administrative appeal, then followed by appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals, or to the courts if they're asserting some constitutional argument. Your Honor, I wanted to just point out one thing on the Gibbs case. I had made a statement in the appellee's brief concerning how the initial refund amount was applied, and I had stated that how the income tax withholding amount that was withheld by the employer from Ms. Gibbs' pay was taken care of by the department, and I had said that was applied to another year's tax liability. Actually, what happened is when the return was filed, the department issued a refund to the Gibbs, and that's where that money went. So the assessment recouped that amount in full. Plus, there was some interest imposed on that as well. But that was I just wanted to correct that for purposes of the brief and for purposes of the statement of facts in that brief. You had asked an interesting question, Mr. Jewett. You said, well, can everyone in Ohio claim this? Is it truly voluntary for everybody? I asked that same question, I can remember several years ago, when another tax protester was involved, and I can remember his answer was very much like Mr. Jewett's. Well, he was saying, well, for me it is, and I guess for others it is, but maybe not for you, and he points to me, because you're a government guy. So somehow if you're a government employee, maybe, you know, all these rationales do apply, I mean, are rejectable, but it seems to suggest, I mean, certainly the logical extension of what Mr. Jewett's saying is that if it's voluntary, it's voluntary. That means it's voluntary for everybody. And of course, if we had a society where no one paid any taxes, we'd have chaos. So really what he's arguing for is anarchy. And certainly, I think it does a great disservice to the Brown versus Education case to say that Plessy versus Ferguson equates to, and the law and the efforts to overturn Plessy versus Ferguson equate to a tax protester who's essentially arguing that government shouldn't be funded by an income tax. When we realize the income tax is fundamental for providing local, state, and federal government services, protects our country, protects us, provides police and fire protection, roads. He couldn't have gotten here today without traveling on public highways. I think it's an outrage, frankly, that these people are allowed to continue to do what they're doing, and I think what we ought to be doing is imposing substantial penalties. And certainly I'd be advocating much more aggressive approach than the courts and frankly our administrators have done.
How does the commissioner decide when to impose the frivolous filing penalty? My recollection is in just one of these cases that was done.
That's a good question, Your Honor. I would say today, now that we've seen hundreds and actually probably thousands of these, it's being applied every time that we see a tax protester type argument advanced. And again, that's where there's substantial W-2 income and they're claiming it's the wages are not taxable and there's no income. In that situation, we're seeing the frivolous filing penalty applied every time. In the Gibbs case, which is the one where it wasn't applied, that was for the 1997 tax year, I believe, that era. That was the earliest one. And at that point, we hadn't seen the flood that we've seen since then. That was the start of the flood. So if you look at the progression, you'll see that as the more currently the commissioner has been extremely uniform applying the frivolous filing penalty in those situations where zero file return is presented and the arguments are tax protester arguments. The same progression I saw at the IRS when I worked briefly for the IRS when I was in law school in the late 70s. There was a reluctance at the beginning to impose substantial penalties, and then when modest penalties or no penalties were applied, you saw the same conduct over and over again. The Gibbs case is a good example. The years we have, I believe, are, I know 1997, I believe, is at issue. For subsequent tax years, the Gibbs were undeterred and they filed again. And then a penalty was applied for the later years. And then they didn't file as another zero return after that. So there clearly is, by applying that sanction, I think there's a deterrent effect. And I certainly believe that it's appropriate to do that. And a lot of the cases that Mr. Jewett has represented his clients before the tax court has seen fit on its own to impose court sanctions for the frivolous filing. And I think it's a reflection of the loss of patience in this whole process. And it's more than that. I think when we have attorneys who are out here advocating clearly frivolous positions that would lead to a state of anarchy in our system, that it's a serious problem. And it's not only a problem with respect to those taxpayers whose employers have withheld taxes, it's also a problem for self-employed individuals and those individuals whose employers, for whatever reason, don't collect the withholding. In those situations, the state's not collecting the revenue at all, as opposed to denying a refund claim. So, you don't want to overstate the situation, but certainly there is a growing taxpayer movement and a tax protester movement, and when attorneys get involved in it, I think that's a very serious matter. And I think this court and the U.S. tax court were totally within their rights to suspend Mr. Jewett's license. And given that he remains remorseless, unrepentant in these positions, I think it's appropriate to continue that suspension for at least so long as he espouses these clearly indefensible positions. We have seen some deterrent effect caused by these frivolous filing penalties. Now that we've seen a diminishment somewhat from the height of this, but I am very concerned about the other aspects where people aren't, working individuals aren't having income tax withheld, and then they're choosing not to file any returns. They remain below the radar screen. In Mr. Jewett's own case, that's the situation. He never raised his hand and said, I believe in these arguments. He waited for the federal agents in the state of Ohio to go after him. He didn't file any returns until such in Ohio, ever. He's never filed any returns. And we only caught him through the federal audit. And I think that's a very dangerous situation where people aren't filing any returns at all and they remain below our radar screen. Our staff, obviously, is not unlimited. And we depend on voluntary compliance in that sense, that people have a responsibility to the government to pay their taxes in a timely manner, to file a return showing what their liability is. That wasn't done here in Mr. Jewett's case. And it wasn't done in the other two situations either. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. Mr. Jewett, you have about 4.5 minutes left. The red light will tell you when your time has expired.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. This argument, his response to the Pat Jeffries question that you asked, I think, is a straw man. Neither myself nor any of my clients has ever made any threats or attempts to harass anybody with the Ohio Tax Department. What we have said was that the person, whoever it was, that made these changes in these returns that individuals filed didn't have any authority to do so, and I don't believe that the evidence will show that these individuals do have that authority. In other words, if you are not a taxpayer, you don't have to file a return. The tax preparation information provided by the state of Ohio says if you have no tax liability, you don't have to file a return. And if I have no tax liability, I don't have to file a return. Now, I may wish to file a return to get a refund if I had something withheld improperly, but I'm not required to file a return. And as an individual who didn't have anything withheld, I filed a zero return with the Internal Revenue Service because I know that sometimes the IRS illegally prosecutes people for not filing any returns at all. So I did file a zero return with the Internal Revenue Service, and it was using those returns and other information that the state received that it formed a basis for claiming that I owed some taxes. But if my legal position is accurate, that I'm not a taxpayer as defined by the Internal Revenue Code and therefore applicable to the state of Ohio, I don't have to file a return. So anyway, the threat argument is a straw man as far as myself and my clients is concerned. Mr. Hubbard indicates that the number of so-called tax protesters is increasing. Well, gee, I wonder why. Is it because they never get a straight answer from the Ohio Department of Taxation when they call and ask them? Is it because they never get a straight answer from the Internal Revenue Service when they have audits, et cetera, et cetera? Well, if that's the case, if they don't have straight answers, if they can't open the code up and show me what section of the code makes me liable for the income tax, gosh, don't you think other people realize that and say, well, then I'm not liable? You know, I mean, it's a simple thing to show where one is liable in the Internal Revenue Code. And to date, no Internal Revenue Service agent has ever opened the code up to me and said, here you are. Now, I would, Hubbard made an interesting comparison. We wouldn't have been able to get here without the public highways. So taxes are necessary. Those taxes, I pay taxes that I'm liable for and for which I have a liability. Every time you buy a gallon of gas, 30 or 40 cents of that goes to the Highway Trust Fund, which provides for highways. Income taxes don't pay a cent toward those highways. They are all funded by those highway taxes. Mr. Hubbard talks about anarchy in the system. Again, it's a simple thing to show people where they're liable, if they're liable. And all of the subterfuge and all of the complaining and all of the so-called penalties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, don't change that single thing. If I'm liable for the so-called income tax, all you have to do is open up the Internal Revenue Code and show me the law. To paraphrase Jerry Maguire, show me the law, don't show me the money, show me the law.
Isn't it the case that these other court decisions that have ruled against the position you're advocating have, in essence, done that? You disagree with
that. No, they have not. None of them have shown me a specific section of the code that says this is why you're liable. What they have done is they've said previous decisions have said you lose, and therefore you lose. They haven't said those previous decisions, and none of those previous decisions has cited any law, no section of the code. It's a remarkable thing. What a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. And that's what the IRS has done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Jewett. Case will be submitted.